Hello there. Today is Tuesday, May 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Obama will deliver a major address in Vietnam with human rights on the agenda Tuesday. Could Vietnam's pho be the next pizza or sushi in the U.S.? A dire warning about the Summer Games in Rio and Zika. The rhetoric heats up as new polls show a tightening race between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton.
Donald Trump actually stood on a debate stage and argued that Americans are being paid too much.
Also ahead, hot air balloons and wine riding high at a California festival. It's all on today's an International Edition. Well, a big announcement Monday by President Barack Obama, who has arrived in Vietnam. Speaking in a news conference with Vietnamese President Tran Đại Quang, Obama said the United States is lifting its longstanding weapons ban on Vietnam.
As with all our defense partners, sales will need to still meet strict requirements, including those related to human rights. But this change will ensure that Vietnam has access to the equipment it needs to defend itself and removes a lingering vestige of the Cold War. It also underscores the commitment of the United States to a fully normalized relationship with Vietnam, including strong defense ties with Vietnam and this region for the long term.
Quang welcomed the move as an end to a painful chapter. Responding to a reporter's question about increased Chinese aggression in the region, the president said the decision was not based on China. Obama will be giving a speech in Hanoi later today that's expected to focus on improved relations between the United States and Vietnam and the need for constructive dialogue between the two countries. White House officials say the president will emphasize the importance of the two nations engaging in meaningful talks when they disagree, including on human rights. Obama will also meet Tuesday with civil society activists as well as young entrepreneurs. In Baltimore, Maryland today here in the U.S., one of the arresting officers of Freddie Gray, a black man who died last April while in police custody, was given the not guilty by a judge. International Edition social media guru G. Abby Lee is here to bring us up to speed on what's trending about the story. Hi, G.
Hi, Lori.
So which account have you been following today?
Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake is someone you want to follow to keep posted in this city's reaction. She's on Twitter at MayorSRB and has more than 81,000 followers.
So what was she tweeting about the verdict?
So she shared an image of her official statement on the decision, and in the statement she said police officers must be afforded the same justice system as every other citizen and asked the people to be patient.
What is the reaction like to that comment?
Very differing reactions. One person responded by pointing out he noticed the mayor listed protecting Baltimore's property and businesses ahead of protecting its people. More than 30 people retweeted that. Now to that tweet, another person argued prosecuting all six officers was ridiculous and that she wasted taxpayers' money by overcharging them. For our listeners outside of the states, Freddie Gray was a 25-year-old black man who died while in police custody. The officer who was acquitted Monday is white, further fueling racial tensions in the country.
What are we hearing from other news outlets on this?
Well, USA Today received many reactions to its tweet that reads like this. Baltimore officer Edward Nera acquitted of the following charges in the Freddie Gray case, and those are assault, misconduct in office, and reckless endangerment. One person wrote, "When they are found not guilty, we are giving the police permission to kill people while in police custody." Hashtag Black Lives Matter. Others still wrote they are relieved that Officer Nero is found not guilty. Lori, back to you.
All right, thanks so much, G. You can follow her online at G. Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. For the first time, a Peace Corps program is set to launch in Vietnam. The rise in death rates of U.S. white women worries health experts. An appeals court tosses out a $1.2 billion fine against Bank of America. Nile crocodiles discovered in Florida's Gator Country. And Angelina Jolie will teach at the London School of Economics. For expanded coverage of these stories and much more, go to voanews.com or download our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. On the U.S. presidential campaign trail, Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton Monday declined an invitation by Fox News to participate in a debate with rival Bernie Sanders in California before that state's June 7th primary. Sanders, meanwhile, predicted Monday that the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia could be, quote, messy. But he added, democracy is not always nice and quiet and gentle.
I certainly will condemn any and all forms of violence. But we are bringing in a lot of new people into the political process, people who have never gone to a convention before, and they hope very much that their voices will be heard.
Clinton and Sanders are competing aggressively in California as the primaries wrap up, but Clinton is close to getting the delegates she needs to seal the nomination. She has been campaigning hard, but also turning her attention to presumptive GOP nominee Donald Trump.
Trump economics is a recipe for lower wages, fewer jobs, more debt. He could bankrupt America like he's bankrupted his companies.
The latest polls for the general election show basically a dead heat between Clinton and Trump. Republicans seem to be slowly rallying behind Trump as their next presidential nominee, even as doubts persist about his fitness for office among some of the party's elites. Trump is also embarking on a bit of an image makeover, as VOA national correspondent Jim Malone reports.
It's been a long climb, but Donald Trump is about to claim a prize virtually no one ever thought he could, the Republican Party's presidential nomination.
We are going to make America great again, greater than ever before, and we're going to have a lot of fun, and we are going to be respected as a country again.
Slowly but surely, Trump is moving to unify the Republican Party behind him, says one of his early supporters in Congress, Chris Collins of New York.
Collaborative, listening, back and forth. That's who Donald Trump is, and America is going to get very comfortable with that as we move on.
If we had guns on the other side, it wouldn't have been that way. I would have, boom.
Trump has also defied conservatives, who warned his nomination would tear the party apart, says conservative pundit Fred Barn.
And I'll have to say, to my surprise, and the Republican Party seems to be mustering behind Trump in a way that sure didn't look likely even a few weeks ago.
At times, Trump seems intent on remaking his image. He took a softer approach in this interview with Megyn Kelly of Fox News, who reminded him he once called her a bimbo.
Well, that was a retweet. Yeah, did I say that?
Many times.
Ooh, okay. Excuse me.
But Trump still has plenty of challenges ahead, winning over voters repelled and frightened by his past rhetoric, says Gallup pollster Frank Newport.
Trump's biggest problems when we say what's negative about Trump to the American people is his personality. He's arrogant, he's a wild man, he's not controlled, he's racist, he says things that he shouldn't and regrets it later. That's what the public tells us.
Whether Trump succeeds in transforming himself from a blustering, undisciplined primary contender into a plausible presidential candidate could determine the outcome of the November election, says analyst Bill Galston.
Americans, I think, at the end of the day, tend to be risk-averse when it comes to selecting a president. They may be dissatisfied with the status quo. Question is whether the alternative represents a safe or safe enough alternative to the status quo. And the scarier Mr. Trump appears, the worse his prospects in November.
But for the moment, Trump is gaining in national polls and now is effectively tied with Hillary Clinton in a likely general election matchup in November.
Y'all ready for this?
Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And you can read more on the story on our website, voanews.com. The top U.S. commander in Afghanistan says the Taliban leader Mullah Muhammad Akhtar Mansour was an obstacle to peace, and his death will have a disruptive effect on the insurgency. General John Nicholson said Monday during a visit to northern Kunduz province that Mansour rejected an offer to participate in the peace process. Taliban leader was killed when a U.S. drone fired on his vehicle in southwestern Pakistani province of Baluchistan. He had emerged as the successor to Taliban founder Mullah Muhammad Omar, whose 2013 death was only revealed last summer. Here to talk more about what all of this may mean, national security correspondent Jeff Seldon. Jeff, are we sure Mansoor is dead?
U.S. officials, Afghan officials are very confident that the strike did take him out. It was a precision airstrike. There were several drones that were flying in this area of Pakistan, which is unusual for the U.S. to carry out a targeted killing like this in Pakistan. But there were several drones in the area, precision strike. There's been a lot of video from the aftermath of the strike, pictures coming out. Some reporters in the area have now seen his passport, which apparently shows that he had been passing through to get back to possibly Afghanistan, but that he may have been even in Iran just hours before the airstrike. So lots of interesting developments around the strike that killed the Taliban leader, but nonetheless significant because he was the leader of the Afghan Taliban. And there's been an uptick in fighting at his direction, but there's also been a push by the Afghan government to try to get peace talks and reconciliation with the Taliban moving forward.
Does this help us, or is he just likely to be succeeded by someone else who will do the same thing?
It's a good question. It's one that intelligence officials are looking at carefully. In some respects, the U.S. will maintain, as with any strike of this sort, that by taking out a top leader of a terrorist group like the Taliban, you eliminate some of the capability, some of the potential that that group has to act. On the other hand, speaking with an intelligence official earlier, the sense is that in the near term, this may not make much of a difference, that a lot of the aggressive tactics, the aggressive battle plans that the Taliban were putting in place for this current fighting season, which is really just getting underway, those are already locked in. So there's not a huge chance that that's going to change just because their leader, Mullah Mansoor, has been killed. Also, the choice facing the Taliban has been consistent for a while now. Continue fighting or pursue peace talks and possibly reconciliation with the Afghanistan government. And so far, the Taliban has chosen to continue fighting. And the intelligence official I spoke to said it looks like that reconciliation for now is an idea that's just not able to gain traction.
Are we making gains overall with taking down the Taliban?
Military officials say that the U.S. is making gains in Afghanistan, but this is where it gets a little bit tricky because, for the most part, the U.S. mission in Afghanistan has been, and the coalition mission to the same degree, has been focused on fighting terror. And by terror, the focus has been on al-Qaeda and also on the nascent movement, the Islamic State movement there, which has been starting to gain traction. And so that's where the focus has been. This steps out of the trend of fighting those types of battles because it directly targeted the Taliban, something the U.S. hasn't done of late. The exceptions have been when U.S. forces or coalition forces have been out with the Afghan forces there and have encountered situations in which Taliban have been firing on them. Then they fired back and they fought back to defend themselves. But again, it's an interesting move by the U.S., A, because they did it in Pakistan, which traditionally they have been doing of late, and B, because it targets specifically. It was a targeted strike that the President Obama, had to sign off on, targeting the Taliban, where most of the efforts of late have been focused on Islamic State and al-Qaeda.
And there are reports now that Mansoor may have been planning attacks on U.S. targets in Afghanistan. For more on the story, go to voanews.com. Well, in February, the World Health Organization declared Zika a global health emergency, and Brazil has been among the most affected countries by the disease that has been linked to birth defects. And with the Summer Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro just a few months away, there is growing concern. I talked about it with University of Ottawa Professor of Law and Population Health, Amir Adaran, who is sounding an alarm. Thanks for being here. You recently you wrote an article in the Harvard Public Health Review, which pretty much gives a dire warning. What specifically is your message?
My message is that Zika is a problem. It is a really quite serious disease in its Brazilian presentation. And I don't think that having the Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, where people can acquire infection and take it to other parts of the world, is wise. At this moment, Brazil is investigating 7,500 cases of what it believes are babies born with very small heads, you've seen the photos, and potentially very severe brain damage. That's what this epidemic looks like, brain-damaged children. And I think there's considerable hazard in sending people from all over the world who gather for the Olympics at Rio, which has one of the highest infection rates in Brazil, so they get infected and potentially spread this. We don't need that.
Well, now the Games are expected to bring about 500,000 foreign tourists to Brazil, but that in itself poses a problem trying to change something like that at this point.
Obviously, there's an issue of money. Now, if the Olympics organizers want this to proceed on its present course and risk the health of the world, I suppose they'll do that. But they may end up finding later on that the Olympics contributed to the spread of Zika. And then what are these? The Olympics of brain damage. If that's the risk that the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, is prepared to face, that these become the games of brain damage, so be it. I can't help them. But I am warning, and others are warning, that it's not worth taking that risk.
You claim that public health officials' response to this situation has just been steeped in denial. Can you elaborate?
For the most part, the Olympics officials haven't cared to think about Zika. The last time the International Olympic Committee said anything was January this year, when they said that Rio would be a safe environment. Well, it's turning out not to be so. Rio has the second highest number of Zika cases of anywhere in Brazil. Its incidence rate of the disease is the fourth highest in Brazil. There's a real risk. And this was not known when, in January, the Olympics officials said this was a safe environment. Things have changed.
The World Health Organization, have they responded to concerns?
The World Health Organization, interestingly, it says that they're monitoring the situation. They haven't said it's safe, but they're under immense pressure, of course, not to say that it's unsafe. When I published my article in the Harvard Review of Public Health, what I warned was that this could risk spreading the epidemic farther and faster. And the World Health Organization hasn't said I'm wrong. If they wanted to, they could refute everything in that article, and they have not done it.
I'm reading a quote here in one news article that said the International Olympic Committee's highest-ranking member, Dick Pound, said in February that the threat of Zika is, quote, manufactured crisis beyond requiring pregnant women to take necessary precautions. How do you respond to that?
The idea that the Olympics officials would call Zika a manufactured crisis is preposterous. Manufactured by whom? Really? Manufactured by whom? This is a real epidemic. There are risks, of course, for pregnant women. We're seeing that in Brazil quite clearly now. But there are risks for adults too. Lesser, but they exist. One of them is Guillain-Barré disease. It's a disease that affects the nervous system. It can cause paralysis in some cases and death in other cases. In most cases, it causes nothing. But it's greatly increased, it appears, by Zika infection.
Would you say Rio is the ground zero of the epidemic?
Ground zero is pretty close to what it is. Last month, it had the highest number of cases in the country. This month, the second highest.
So what do you say to Americans, or anyone for that matter, overseas coming to Rio despite your warnings and attending the Games?
The risk to them is, let's face it, low. Most people aren't going to get Zika. And those who are at risk can take the usual precautions. Don't get bitten by mosquitoes. Don't have unprotected sex. What's different, though, is the risk that those people pose to global health when they go home. Because if any of them does acquire the infection and returns home to a place where other mosquitoes can transmit the disease, that amounts to seeding the epidemic. And that is a risk that the world should not have to assume just for the Olympic Committee's convenience.
That was University of Ottawa Professor of Law and Health Amir Adaran. This is International Edition.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, by coincidence, we think, while President Obama is in Vietnam, popularity of Vietnamese food in the United States has been skyrocketing. VOA's Jim Randall joined International Edition's Susan Yackey to talk more about it.
There's a soup, a wonderful soup, called pho, which rhymes with duh, and it's spelled P-H-O, which for an English speaker seems odd. But anyway, it's made with beef bones, and they cook them all night, you know, for 12 hours, and you get this very rich broth, and every restaurant, and there are almost 9,000 Vietnamese restaurants now in the United States, which is a big increase from previous years. Everyone seems to have their own secret brand of spices. I went to a Vietnamese restaurant, and they showed us how it's done, except for the spices. They wouldn't show us that.
And what else is in it beside the spices?
Well, there's lots of beef bones, like 45 kilograms of beef bones, which cook all night. And then there's late in the process, they put in enormous chunks. It looks like half a cow.
Oh.
It's really quite a concoction, and then it's served many, many steps, but it's served this very clear, very tasty broth is served with rice noodles and an incredible array of condiments and spices and so forth, many of which the customer is able to put in, you know, to customize it to that person's exact taste.
Mm-hmm. And you spoke to the chef.
I spoke to the chef, and I devoured the soup. It was quite good. But I also spoke to a food critic in Oklahoma, which is not the first place you'd think
of a Vietnamese restaurant in Oklahoma.
For any kind of food trend. But he said there's a substantial Vietnamese community there, and they have taken a very bedraggled and downtrodden area of the city, and they've spruced it all up, and they've opened lots of shops and restaurants, and they're doing pretty well. And also in Austin, Texas, there was I spoke with an entrepreneur who's running five Vietnamese restaurants, and they're called Fanatic.
Which is a
pun in English, and that was pretty good. And they talked about why it's popular. It's popular because it's new. Tastes great. It's popular because it's pretty nutritious. It doesn't have a lot of fat. It has a modest number of calories, lots of veggies and stuff. So, and it seems to be growing ever more popular. And the question I put to the food critic was, well, is this ethnic niche dish on its way to becoming one of these all-American foods, you know, like Italian pizza or Japanese sushi or Mexican salsa? And he was sort of hemming and hawing. He said, well, it's kind of different. I don't know. Maybe it is. But the chef said they wouldn't be surprised to see more Vietnamese restaurants. It wouldn't be surprised to see pho showing up in other ethnic restaurants or in just mainstream restaurants. And I think it's a barometer of the growing popularity and the growing influence of Vietnamese in America.
That was VOA's Jim Randall speaking with Susan Yackey. Well, communities in the United States often hold festivals to show what makes them special. And in California, for example, we've got farmers near Fresno celebrating figs, those around the Gilmore area showcasing garlic. And Mike O'Sullivan tells us about the wine-producing region of Temecula, which offers local vintages in an annual festival where rides on hot air balloons are adding to the excitement.
Dozens of hot air balloonists come to Temecula Valley, north of San Diego, one weekend every May. The site is spectacular, and for pilots and lucky passengers, when conditions are right, the ride is exciting yet peaceful.
The appeal of ballooning, it's the ability to just leave all your worries on the ground.
The balloons get their lift from air heated by propane burners.
We have no control over left or right. We can go up and down, but we really are at the mercy of the wind. It's just the most peaceful feeling in the world.
The festival has grown in its 33 years of operation.
The hot air balloons in the morning and then transitioning over into the wines and what the valley here has to offer.
Temecula Valley, with more than 40 wineries, is the largest wine-producing region of Southern California. Visitors can try the local vintages.
I like weather and wine and balloon. Yeah, I like it.
The vintners range from large to small and include the three-year-old winery of a husband and wife team, the Lorenzis.
Our Italian friend said, I could show you how to make wine. So he made, I swear, 1 gallon, and the rest was history.
The local history and wines are on display each year with a stunning display of hot air balloons added for good measure.
All right, well, that is going to do it for this edition of International Edition. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. You can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Chaz Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Embassy in Yaounde welcomed students from the International Marketing and Regional Integration Programs of the International Relations Institute of Cameroon, or IRIC, to the James Baldwin Information Resource Center, or IRC, to acquaint themselves with the functioning of the center and to have access to relevant sources for their academic research work. The James Baldwin Information Resource Center is a component of the Public Affairs section of the U.S. Embassy in Yaounde. It is a public lending library for students, academia, and the general public, and a reference research center which provides comprehensive and authoritative information on the United States. Embassy Affairs Officer Roberto Quiroz II congratulated the students on their admission into such a prestigious institution as IRIC. This is an effort the United States of America is proud to offer Cameroon in a support role, he said. The real credit for all efforts go to Cameroon and Lake Chad Basin nations because they are leading all security efforts. All Cameroonians must be proud of how their sons and daughters in uniform have not hesitated to defend their homeland and fellow citizens against Boko Haram's attacks, which have victimized innocent civilians and targeted women and girls. Mr. Quiroz said Boko Haram will be defeated so that Cameroonians can build a future of peace and prosperity through their own talents and ideas. He also underscored other areas of partnership between both nations, including the protection of refugees fleeing violence, U.S. support for a vibrant civil society, growing private sector to create jobs and a free media, and joint efforts to protect wildlife. Mr. Quiroz also explained how diplomacy is an instrument of advancing good governance goals, adding that public perception of their performance as IRIC students and future diplomats and civil servants is very important as well. Congratulations on your achievements, he told the students. As future leaders in your fields, your first and foremost priority will be to advance the interests of Cameroon. That is a great responsibility. The United States is proud to work with its partner Cameroon for the benefit of both nations, the region, and Africa.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
for what's your